Hi, I'm Brian McCreath. This is The Answered Question from WCRB in Boston for April 21st, 2016. Mahler 9. There's weight to those words. More, I think, than for other pieces of music. I mean, you can say Tchaikovsky 5 or Beethoven 7 or even Mahler 3. And if you know those pieces, you might get a particular impression in your mind. But Mahler 9 is such a powerful piece that, to me, that impression kind of pushes a pause button in my thoughts. And I don't think I'm unique in that reaction. In fact, I remember watching St. Elmo's Fire, that Brat Pack movie from about 30 years ago. And in this breakup scene between Ally Sheedy and Judd Nelson's characters, they're dividing their record collection, and they argue over who gets the recording of Mahler's Ninth Symphony. It's one little detail in the scene that's supposed to tell us how intelligent these young adults are. It's just a tiny little moment, but it works because they're not arguing over, say, Mendelssohn 4 or Brahms 1. It's Mahler 9. The Boston Symphony performed Mahler 9 last week with music director Andras Nelsons. You were just hearing a bit of it. And you can hear the entire performance at our website, classicalwcrb.org. Andras talked about it last week on The Answered Question, and he's back for this week's episode. But this time, it's a conversation with Andras and his wife, Christina Opelijs. They spent some time with Ron Della Chiesa, and that's coming up. Also on the podcast today, Kathy Fuller talks with Christian and Tanya Tetzloff and Lars Vogt. They played a concert presented by the Celebrity Series of Boston, and we'll have it for you on the air on Sunday night at 7 and on demand at our website after that. Again, it's all at classicalwcrb.org. I don't think it's too useful to rank composers, but I will say that there are three composers who are essentially responsible for drawing me into music. Mahler is one of them. And by the way, I'll just let you guess who the other two are. It's not that I think Mahler is better than other composers. I just mean that his music means more to me than just about everyone else's. Having said that, Mahler 9 was a piece that I really struggled to plug into for years. I couldn't quite grasp what was going on with it. That changed in 2007 in a Boston Symphony performance led by James Levine. It really was a revelation. I got it. At least for me. What I heard in that concert that I had never really perceived before was memory. And not just one part of the piece echoing another part to give the impression of having a memory, though that does happen in Mahler 9. What I mean is that I heard the way memory works in our brains, with part of a thought returning, but not in its complete form, and another part of the same memory popping up somewhere else, but in such a different setting that it changes the meaning and even the substance of the memory itself. It was one of those rare concerts where, when I walked out, I had a totally new understanding, not just of what Mahler did with that piece, but what Mahler himself understood about the rest of us. So here's a highlight from last Saturday's concert. This is the part of the third movement. It's a moment that takes an idea that the orchestra has already been working over, and suddenly it's transformed into something different. And yes, part of why that moment stands out for me is that it's a trumpet solo, played there by Tom Rolfes, by the way. But it's also emblematic of what Mahler does throughout the piece, taking painful emotions and transforming them. He doesn't make the pain go away, but by composing music that emulates the process of memory itself, Mahler gives us something that might even help with our own pain. Okay, sorry to get a bit heavy on you, but, you know, Mahler 9. And remember, that entire performance is available to hear at our website, classicalwcrb.org/BSO. This week, Andres Nelsons is leading the last BSO subscription program of the season. Part of it is French music, including Dutilleux's Métabol, Debussy's La Mer, and Ravel's La Valse. And part of it is Russian, including Rachmaninoff's How Fair Is This Place, and the letter scene from Tchaikovsky's Eugene Onegin. And the soprano who's singing both of those pieces is Christina Opelais. She's a huge star at the Metropolitan Opera and other houses around the world, and she's Andres's wife. So it was a true pleasure to have both of them stop by our studio to talk with my friend and colleague, Ron Della Chiesa. Ron is an opera fanatic, so he launched into the conversation by talking to Christina about a composer she's become especially well known for.
Puccini has been very good to you. I know that he's a special place in your heart for Puccini.
Yes, that's true. I feel very special with Puccini. I have feelings, sometimes it's scary. It scared me because sometimes I feel like he's helping me to understand more what he was writing. And I really feel this music in a very deep, like it's in my blood, you know. It's like intuition really there, and I understand how to build the phrases. And I'm really happy during the singing Puccini. So I think that this happiness when you're really in love with music, it's very important for singers.
And for you too, on stage, your acting and how into the role you are, you live every line of Butterfly and Manosco.
Especially Butterfly, I must say, because I as a mother, I'm sure, because I'm a mother, so I feel this character very, very well, and I live this destiny. It's a huge tragedy because Chiyo-Chan kind of perfect. She's the most complete woman, I would say, from all opera characters, from all opera women. So because she's the real woman, and this is almost impossible to be like Chiyo-Chan, completely pure person, a real mother. A real woman, a real wife, you know, it's a fantastic to really live this destiny on stage.
Andres, there's a wonderful interlude in Madame Butterfly where they are waiting, Chocho-san is waiting with Suzuki, and Puccini writes this music. It just pours out of him, and he goes back and he quotes some of the things from the duet.
Yeah. It is worth your tears, you know. If you go to Butterfly, and if you know the story, of course, you are in tears in this moment because you know how it's going to end. But this music is so beautiful and so still, but still he makes you hope. Even you know how it's going to end. Maybe this time it will end differently. You know, kind of. Oh my God, Puccini is a master of a dramaturgy of emotions. You know, he just squeezes out all the liquid. Sorry, you know, you just it is a master. And in the meantime, this is kind of relatively sometimes simple love stories, you would think, but actually it's essence of life. It's actually it's a relationship and love and all you know, sacrifice and all these hugest. You know, acts in life. It's actually to sacrifice for someone, and that's what Butterfly does. I mean, she sacrifices herself for her love and for her child. So this is just it's much more than creating. You know, inventing it. I think it's much more than inventing a plane. You know, to sacrifice. You know, in terms of how the big act it is, you know, I think for humanity.
Right. What he does, I mean, and he does it again and again. He bears his soul for everybody. And we could talk about Manolo too. That's a whole other story because he wrote a great intermezzo there. I mean, that you played opening night when you were both here.
Yeah.
You did the duet for Manolo Scott. Yeah. And but I want to talk about Onegin because we're very excited about this. It's here in Boston to do the famous letter scene, Tatiana's letter scene. I was thinking about Tatiana today. Would she have Facebook, I wonder? A Facebook page to write about this, you know,
no,
this letter?
That would be...
But set that up because the letter scene from Onegin is one of the great tour de forces for a soprano. And you're going to sing that with Andres and Boston Symphony.
Absolutely, yeah. And that also, I must mention, of course, Tchaikovsky, who is one of the most favorite composers. And music is so touching and so romantic. And I love to sing this scene maybe I'm not completely in love with all role of Tatiana, but the latter scene is really so special to me. I don't know. It's kind of every girl and every woman and every mother, you know, as a mother now, I remember, of course, myself when I was a teenager. And I think it's so close to everyone, you know, this feeling when you are afraid to open your love. You don't know how to explain. You don't know how to say in a correct way. And, of course, all this charming way of writing that, you know, because now we have no idea, probably, the new generation, especially in the trouble now, they're not writing. So, and I think now it's such a special thing to show and to feel, especially when you're on stage during the acting, you know, this is so special to write the letter.
Right.
To say what you feel.
A personal letter like that, to write the way she does it.
Yeah.
And, of course, she's in love at first sight with Onegin, right? I mean, she just sees him, even though he makes a play for Olga.
Yeah.
But she feels in her heart Onegin is the one, right, Andres?
Yeah, she,
from the beginning.
I think it's from the beginning. She actually,
even at the end.
I think before even seeing him, of course, I think she is in love somewhere.
With someone.
Well, you know, from the stories about Onegin and before seeing him, I think. I think this is, and but I think it's actually, to me, looking to the perspective of Onegin and others, you know, his symphonies and the other operas, Pig Dam, I think he is putting himself in place of Tatiana somehow. I think in Onegin, Tchaikovsky is in his character is in Tatiana, and the same is I can see in personally in, you know, his Herman in Pig Dam. I mean, he kind of associates himself a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
He's not in Onegin's side. He would do Tchaikovsky himself would want to end it differently. He, you know, I think that love story. So he is in place. I find it's Tchaikovsky's intimate love letter actually to somebody, you know, from himself. It is in Tatiana's letter scene. It's so, I think it's so deep, so sincere and so beautiful and so sad and so touching.
Melancholy, you know, the quality of the term melancholy for Tchaikovsky resonates so much with me. There's melancholy in Puccini, but it's a different kind of melancholy.
Different kind of,
different
yeah.
Kind. Intimate.
It's a different. It's more naive. Because Puccini is a lot of passion. So if some women of Puccini music would write this letter, she would be more aggressive, probably, with passion. But Tatiana is really very shy. Tatiana is very, you know, very soft person. So this is a more melancholic. So this is a really more Tchaikovsky way.
Yeah, I want to ask you about the person. There's a wonderful personal connection between the aria that you have together, going back to Riga, right?
Yes.
Can you talk about that? Because it's a good story.
Yeah, you know, I firstly, we met in Riga, of course, and we met actually first, it was through music, through opera, and it was Bohème, and I was conducting, and she was singing, so, but then we were like friends, you know, when I heard her singing Tatiana's letter scene, I just thought something is going on. I knew I loved that piece of music so much, but I think there's something was bothering me more, and I realized that I got in love in that moment, which, you know, she was singing Tatiana's letter scene in Riga. And so it's kind of symbolic to perform it now as well, now here in Boston. I mean, she does it absolutely amazing. It's so passionate, and of course, I mean, for me, to perform it with her and with Boston Symphony, which is absolutely amazing orchestra, because you need, you know, it's not often you can get a combination of amazing voice, amazing passion in a voice to build the dramaturgy of that scene, and to have a brilliant orchestral playing which supports that. And this is, I'm really very, very, very thrilled that we have this great combination, you know. And
you do.
It's amazing,
and as I say, in you know, in terms of what you're doing together, you're a hot couple right now. I mean, you really are. Vanity Fair, you know, you got a piece in Vanity Fair. And you are next season, you're doing a new production of Rusalka for you. For you at the Met, Peter Gelb says it's for you,
yes,
this new production.
I really
You're going to be singing Tosca next year, I understand.
Yes.
And
I honored. I really honored, and I'm very surprised that Mr. Gelb opened so much future already to the audience.
Well, I'm not surprised. So, I don't think anybody heard you. Surprised,
and for me, it's a huge honor because I have to say that since my debut, I felt very special in this house, very special with the people who work in this house, and very special with the audience. Yeah, it was a laugh from the real laugh from the beginning, and it's really a huge continuation for me, and I'm happy to perform at the Met stage.
Let's talk about this summer at Tanglewood, Andres, because you're going to do Aida, Acts 1 and 2 of Aida with Kristina.
Uh-huh.
And any particular demands this makes on your voice that are different than Puccini?
Definitely. When you change the composer, also the style is became different. What is important is just be yourself, of course. But Verdi is not Puccini, so Puccini is not Verdi. That's it. It's very easy to understand. But, of course, it's less freedom. For me, Puccini is a lot of freedom in the music, also in the interpretation. In Verdi, you have to be more fixed, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
So you cannot be over too much. With Puccini, you can be over with some fermato, you know, holding high note or say something as a recitative, you know, not singing, but say something as a voice, a speaking voice. So in Verdi, it's not a lot of possibilities to do that. But Aida is very special to me, too, because my first Aida was with Andris.
Really?
I sang just few performances in our country, in our first opera, Riga Opera, and it was with Andris. So this is again very special that we do this together, that I come back for this role with Andris.
Wonderful. That's at Tanglewood. That's really good.
Yes.
That's in Tanglewood in summer, and so I'm really happy to, Kristina comes again and with the Boston Symphony. Yeah.
Let's talk about Adriana, because she's 4 years old.
Yeah.
Your great production together.
Yes.
And she is, as I mentioned, when you came into the studio, Adriana Lecouvreur by Chilea, a beautiful opera.
Amazing opera.
Chilea out of the Verismo school, mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you said maybe someday you will do that role.
I am sure I will do this role one day. Not very soon, because this role, I don't know, usually this role you take after... You really have a strong positions and you sang a lot of roles. So this is I don't like to say that, but unfortunately in opera world, this role is a little bit diva's role, prima donna's role. So you have to be really a big name to sing this role. So I should wait. I should wait, because I feel I'm from the beginning of my, I hope, big way to do this profession. But definitely, I definitely feel that I will sing this role.
Andres, you have had a wonderful season this year, your second full season as music director of this orchestra, working your way through Dmitri Shostakovich, through hopefully all 15 symphonies, right?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, this is a final week of our second season together. And of course, as I earlier have mentioned a lot, that every program, every concert, every program, we get to know each other better and better, and actually get in love with, I love the orchestra really hugely, and I see more and more qualities of this amazing orchestra, the colors of the sound with a different repertoire. I experience different, and now, we do this week, of course, besides Tatiana's Letter Scene and Rachmaninoff's song, we do a French, so it's a Russian-French song, we do La Mer and Laval, so this the big two big, impressionistic pieces. I'm looking forward to perform La Mer. I haven't performed La Mer together, so I'm looking forward to more. We have rehearsal to rehearse and to again experience another colors which this amazing orchestra will give, and I think this I really I'm just absolutely happy and excited, and we of course already looking forward to, of course, Tanglewood. We are now going on big tour Kristina being a soloist in one of the programs, and we do Mahler 9 symphony on tour, and of course I'm looking forward to Tanglewood, but the next season is announced, and it's very exciting. When I keep looking in the brochure, I think, oh my God, it's such many things. We have a Rosenkavalier Concertante, we have Brahms cycle, we have so many, we have the top pianists in, you know, the most exciting pianists in the world in the season. We have Tom Adesh as our guest artistical partner, and we have so many different. Christine is coming back as well.
Malafour. Exactly. Wonderful. That's going to be something to look forward to.
So we have, you know, great soloists, great conductors, and I'm so excited about the next season as well. So, you know, the time runs very fast, and we had a planning meeting, so we're kind of with the dreams and ideas clear what happens until 22. So we won't need to plan ahead of 22.
You plan maybe to spend more time in Boston together with Adriana? Maybe take up some residence here?
I mean, we are thinking of that. Of course, firstly, the practical things, like, it's great that Christina is, she's about 3 months, if not more, every year at the Metropolitan Opera. So it's not far. And then, of course, she's so happy that we're thrilled that she's also almost every season she can be and sing with us with Boston Symphony. So Adriana is already in this continent. So, and as she grows bigger, so I can take a week her. So actually, we are thinking looking into finding a resident place. And of course, our home is in Latvia, although we are not often there, but that's our. Mm-hmm. Home base, but otherwise, then it's traveling, and Boston is of course my musical home, and it's very close to Christina's. Very often, you know,
being at the Met, yeah,
being at the Met. So we have a wonderful Latvian community here, you know.
Yeah, it's awesome.
My wife absolutely. And I live in the Polish Triangle, which overlaps with the Latvian community in our neighborhood. So I hear. Latvian, I hear
that's
Polish.
That's a good thing. That's amazing.
There's a big Latvians.
It's a big thing, actually.
Of course, our own accent is Dorchester. The car. You got to get in the car and drive the car. I want to drive Andres and Christina home because they get the car and we'll go home. That's Dorchester.
Uh-huh, I see.
Really?
Listen, it's great having you here. I wish you great success. You're already well on your way, and it's just a privilege to have you with us.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for the invitation.
Thank you.
Buon viaggio.
Thank you.
Andres Nelsons and Christina Opelijs are performing together this week with the Boston Symphony Orchestra, and we'll have the concert for you live from Symphony Hall at 8 p.m. on Saturday night at 99.5 FM in Boston and streaming live at classicalwcrb.org. You'll also have a chance to hear the concert on demand next week at that website and in an encore broadcast on Monday, May 2nd. This weekend, you also have the chance to hear a superb chamber music concert presented by the Celebrity Series of Boston. It's a piano trio performance by violinist Christian Tetzlaff, cellist Tanya Tetzlaff, and yes, they're siblings, and pianist Lars Vogt. Kathy Fuller spent some time talking with all of them at Jordan Hall when they were in town in February.
Basically, we're in the 19th century right now with Brahms and a couple of the people who meant an awful lot to him, Dvorak and Schumann. I'd love to ask each of you right off the bat, which of these composers is the easiest for you personally to sort of step into their world? Which one do you have a biggest affinity with, Tanya?
I couldn't even say, because it's all three of them are really one favorite composers of me. And it's a very different feeling performing the three pieces we are performing today. Of course, for me as a cellist, the Domki Trio is very rewarding, and you can just dive into the music. It's very comfortable to play. And at the same time, you deep dive into this sadness, melancholy, and also the wild side of the piece. But I love as much to play the Brahms and the Schumann. And Schumann is especially important to us because I think very often he's a little bit underestimated, is that the word? And we would love to show to everybody that he's a fantastic, great composer speaking directly from his heart in his music.
Christian, what about you?
The trios I first played was from this program was the B major Brahms, so that is a long-standing friend, like a lot of Brahms music. But I only can say that the Schumann, all the three Schumann trios are among his most fantastic and wildest creations. So we have a joy of exploration in every performance with this sometimes really jumping from one extreme to the other composer. So if we played now those pieces nine times, and it's not like one is always rewarding the other's not. This program has become a whole package, and what I notice is that it looks a bit lame on the program. Yeah, they are playing Schumann, Dvorak, and Brahms. Yeah, okay. And where's the excitement? And then you, especially in the program with the C major Brahms trio, you find that all three composers were really living on the edge with these compositions. So the aspect of modern or old or romantic or brainy or whatever, they don't count anymore. They both cover everything one possibly can say on an instrument.
Lars Vogt?
Well, I agree. I mean, when I'm playing the one composer, I'm thinking, that's my absolute favorite. Nothing can live up to that. And then I play the other one, and then I think that one's the one. So they're all three so close to my heart in different ways. And it's also been a journey. Like Christian said, Brahms has been, for me, also the longest standing friend since sort of my teenage years. Dvořák, I came to really love sort of in my late 20s when we started to do much more intensely chamber music, and at my festival in Heimbach and so on, we discovered piece by piece of Dvořák chamber music and just fell in love with every single one. And Schumann, the older I get, the more I find that maybe Schumann is the best composer of all.
Well, maybe extreme is the binding aspect of this whole program. They all go to great extremes. Is it that they all navigate to their extremes in a different way? How does Schumann navigate from one extreme to another?
Well, for instance, we have a slow movement here in this trio that starts with a really loving, serene, big melody, but he cannot let it stand for more than 1 minute, and then total interruptions of two very different couplets, one funeral march-like, and then agitato bits, and it's all mixed in together, and then the melody comes back, transformed through that, but it's deep beauty, but it's not any kind of settled beauty that we find, for instance, in the slow movement of the Brahms or in longer stretches even of the Dumky trio, which is, of course, the idea of jumping from one to the other. But it seems in the Schumann, it seems to happen almost at the same time. So it may be the only disadvantage for me is that it really takes a little while sinking into his spirit. And we try in a performance, but we are so sold on the piece. We love it so much but I can understand also that there's an element of, oh, I would like to hear that again. And that's how modern Schumann is as a composer.
Actually, you can't listen to the Schumann leaning back. I think you really have to be open and alert. It's nothing you can sink into, because one moment it's the one atmosphere, then the next appears so suddenly that you might get not the real deep inside if you're not really listening every second to it.
Is there anything
the most neurotic of the three in a wonderful way?
Yeah.
Being Florestan and Eusebius at the same time.
Both extremes. Mm-hmm. Is there anything you would ask him if we could get him to show up, Mr. Schumann?
How did you have these wonderful ideas? We would kneel down in front of him and say, Robert, don't say anything, which he probably wouldn't anyway.
Yeah, he was a taciturn person. Yeah, so, I think so I would ask him, I thought you were dead.
The Brahms, let me move to the Brahms. It starts out with this open-hearted, warm piano, and then the cello, right? And then when the violin comes in, I always get goosebumps. Why do I get goosebumps when you join her?
Well, you haven't heard me do it. Maybe you don't get them with me.
So much for goosebumps.
But,
I get constant goosebumps with the two of them. I get constant goosebumps.
It might be actually also something visual, or knowing it's a piano trio and he starts alone and then the group is complete and sings together. It's a social aspect of it is maybe nice.
Community. Because first the circle is completed.
It sounds for a moment like a cello sonata. And okay, now we get together.
Actually, there are a couple of very, very touching moments in the whole piece when we play exactly the same, even in the same octave. And for me, these are also the moments when I think, wow, it's very beautiful if one person is pouring out the heart. But if it's a duet and even the same words are spoken by two people, then it's just totally smashing and very emotional.
There's something happening in the Schumann trio where he's actually talking to Clara because he quotes the song "Your Beautiful Picture Is With Me," which is from a song cycle which he wrote to her. So in this piano trio, he evokes her. First, the violin does it, then the cello, and at the recapitulation, he splits the melody between us. So it's like a loving encounter of both of them. And of course, in a piano trio, as it is one guy at the piano and two with similar instruments, that interplay is used by all the composers to also to visible contact and dialogue.
And that happens in the Dvorak also?
Yeah.
Of course. Now, Dvorak is navigating extremes in a way they're built into. What is a dumki? Can you say what a dumki is?
We have already been talking about that a couple of times because there are different explanations. As far as I knew, dumka was old narrative about heroes, like folk tales that were told, not written down, but told. So this is concerning, of course, very much the aspect of the folk music influence in that piece. But it's, I think, also this tragedy that the old fairy tales always contain, the extreme fear, the extreme sadness, but also the extreme joy and wildness. And I think that's what Dvořák puts to an extreme in this piece. And it's every evening, I mean, it's never getting to the point where you think, now it's the sixth time we play this, so it might get a little bit normal. Every time you are so touched that it's hard to keep your emotions together.
And the narrative aspect of, if we believe in the dumka as being a tale, is also that in the story very often things just happen and they are not developed from the musical material, but they happen because things do happen in life. And that's what makes the sometimes jumping way of composing plausible in a tale rather in a constructed sonata movement.
This is such a romantic program. You know this famous Novalis phrase that romanticism is about making the familiar strange and the strange familiar. Do you think that that applies?
It takes a while to get that whole sentence deeply inside. But I know, like E.T.A. Hoffmann, who would describe the total normal scenes and then they would turn into nightmares. But Schumann probably is mostly talking about these things that are happening inside. So maybe it's not. But it's also transforming a sonata movement into a wild story, but also Beethoven sometimes did that.
There's connection, maybe. When Schumann, in bits of the second movement particularly, he seems to evoke really old times for me, in this chorale.
Yeah.
And it really seems like he's going back to Middle Ages, and he loves this idea of fairy tales. He's got all these fairy tale forms also in chamber music and so on. And also in piano music, there are all these poetic titles that he gives to pieces, often to do with old stories. So maybe there is also this little bit of the link to the Dvořák.
But what I really like now that I think about is that to make the strange normal is the almost the stronger sentence. And it is that he's looking inside. And most of us, if we look inside, we see strange creatures and amazing things, some to show, some not to show. And that he creates a piano trio out of that. That is making something totally wild and dangerous and beautiful into something that you can present, you can print it on paper, and you can listen to it.
I always have this feeling with Schumann particularly that sometimes I actually feel protective of him when I see his music, because I'm thinking, my God, he is so open. He really takes the inside, deepest inside of the soul, and just shows it out. Here it is. Here it is for everyone to see. As vulnerable as it is, as wild, as neurotic, as weird. And God, I mean, as you said, I mean, we all have that in us, but who dares show it?
Maybe that's what you would do if you met him. Maybe you would just take care of him.
But that's the other way around. Also, maybe the therapy aspect for him, but also I hope always when playing, the therapeutic effect for all of us, that being confronted with somebody so open and saying this is our souls, it is for me often a relief to just be allowed to see that we share in that, and that it's binding us humans as to be non-computers, non-robots, but allowing ourselves to confront those things.
And it's crazy how, especially with Dvořák, even people who have nothing to do with classical music, or kids, children, listening to Dvořák music, they will be deeply, deeply touched and feeling exactly the same things that I am feeling, because it connects us in a way that is absolutely direct. And it's very beautiful to experience.
Well, as far as therapy is concerned, how is the tour? Do you need therapy to do a tour like this?
Psychotherapy.
How do you deal with all
that? That's possible.
For me, it's usually gin tonic.
Actually, I think for all of us, it's also sometimes nearly relaxing to get away from home, because we have all very complicated lives with lots of kids and lots of things to take care of. So when you're on tour, suddenly it's about music and it's about spending time together. And as we get along very beautifully,
it's only about survival all of a sudden.
And it's so that for me, this how long is it now? 12 days were really a fantastic time with a very focused time on music and on friendship.
Which of the trios has changed the most in the tour? Has any of them surprised you in any way?
Dvořák is definitely the newest for us, I think, and so I found that there's we're sort of that was maybe the most exciting journey to make it ours, sort of in that sense. The other pieces we've played more, but there's also constant discovery, even in the Brahms trio, which I've played so much even since I was a kid, basically, well, a teenager, where at some point you think, you know the piece basically, but every time we give it also a different edge, and it goes a little bit more in this direction, it goes a little bit more in that direction, and now we play it a bit more melodic, now we give it a bit more action. And we just feel that together when that's happening, and that's really exciting.
And it's not only in the performances, where we, yeah, of course, we try out things and we try to read the other's minds and tell a new story every evening, but also suddenly it can happen that in a warming up rehearsal in some place, suddenly a new idea occurs. And even if we don't follow this idea, just to think about a place once more very deeply and try out three different versions changes everything. And this is how it never gets boring, the job.
Well, your cello is... Is it the Guadagnini still that you're... So this is like 240 years old, right? This year, I think.
It was built 1776.
Yeah, right. 76. But you have a new instrument. Yours is a newly made. When was yours
it's
made?
It's a Peter Greiner built in 2000.
2000. And did you ever have an old instrument?
Yeah, I played two different Stradivaris and one Guadagnini till I got the Greiner. Or a Greiner.
But this one is the one that matches you the best?
I don't know. I'm maybe not totally into this thing of choosing. And I just, he had it and I played it. So I think this is better than the one I had before. So I play this now for 5 years. I like it a lot, but I think all instruments have some good sides and some less good sides. Also, the best Stradivarius for some people might be too bright or too dark. It's a open field, and I actually even like the aspect of changing from time to time.
Are they like brother and sister? Do they read each other's minds or anything weird like that?
There's definitely a closeness that is quite touching, and I like being sort of an honorary member of the family.
We
come
adopted
on, you're at least as much
adopted
my twin than she is.
You got to be jealous that you're constantly being handed a different instrument, but boy, do you handle them well.
The different instruments.
Yeah, you're always, I mean, they get to at least hang on to their instruments, right?
Yeah, I mean, it can be a challenge. It's definitely, especially when you've really liked one evening, and then to go to another one, and even if it's really good, and this is a lovely piano here, it takes a moment, it's a different character. It's really like a different person. And but it's also, I also find that a good challenge in the end. I wouldn't want to have it any other way, I think.
Well, we're glad you're finishing up your tour in Jordan Hall, and I hope that you enjoy yourselves thoroughly.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Kathy Fuller with Christian and Tanya Tetzloff and Lars Vogt. You can hear their Celebrity Series concert on Sunday night at 7 p.m. And check back there after the broadcast to hear it on demand at our website, classicalwcrb.org. That's where you'll see some of the other performances we'll be bringing you on Sunday nights in the coming weeks. Again, that's at classicalwcrb.org. The Answered Question is part of WCRB's SoundCloud, Facebook, and Twitter feeds, and you can also find it at that website, classicalwcrb.org. And be sure to subscribe to TAQ at iTunes or through whichever podcast app you use. Thanks to our many guests on this podcast, including Andres Nelsons and Christina Opelais, Christian and Tanya Tetzloff, and Lars Vogt. Thanks as well to my fabulous WCRB colleagues, Ron Della Chiesa and Kathy Fuller. And thanks as well to the staffs of the BSO and the Celebrity Series of Boston for their help in arranging for these conversations. I'm Brian McCreath. Thanks for listening.